unregulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad to be with you once again today. We're going to be taking a look at a couple of the 18 amicus briefs that have been filed with the Supreme Court over the past couple of days in the case of Smith & Wesson. Actually, I guess it's the Mexican government versus Smith & Wesson, right? I think at the Supreme Court, this is actually Smith & Wesson brands et al. Versus Estados Unidos Mexicanos. But the original lawsuit was filed by the Mexican government against Smith & Wesson and several other firearms manufacturers, accusing them of aiding and abetting the cartel violence south of the border. Now, this case was filed a couple of years ago. Jonathan Lowy, who was used to be with Brady, is now the lead litigator for a group called, I think it's a Global Action Against Gun Violence. They're working with the Mexican government in bringing this lawsuit against many of the major players in the firearms industry. Not all of them, it should be noted. For example, SIG is not a part of this lawsuit. Coincidentally or not, SIG also has a pretty big contract with the Mexican government. So I think the Mexican government is kind of putting their thumb on the scales here. I don't think they want to upset the apple cart when it comes to some of these brands that they're doing business with. But other than that, yeah, it's fair game, right, to go after these U.S. gun makers, accusing them, again, of fueling the cartel violence, of knowingly fueling the cartel violence. What's their evidence for that? They don't have really any. Their claims are basically that U.S. gun makers know that some of their products are going to be illegally diverted, are therefore not doing enough to stop those illegal diversions, and therefore need to have all types of restrictions imposed on them by the judiciary, as opposed to imposing them through, I don't know, say Congress or a vote of the people. This case has had sort of a tortured history. So U.S. District Judge Dennis Saylor originally dismissed the claims brought by the Mexican government, but the First Circuit Court of Appeals reinstated the lawsuit, saying that the Mexican government may be able to prevail on the predicate exception to the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act broadly prevents gun makers from being sued over the third-party actions of criminals. But under this predicate cause exception, if a claim can be made that the actions of the gun maker led directly to the harm suffered by the plaintiffs, then supposedly the lawsuit can proceed. So the U.S. First District, the First Circuit Court of Appeals used that predicate exception to reinstate the lawsuit. Now, Judge Saylor has since gone back and dismissed once again most of these claims against gun makers who have no business in the state of Massachusetts, which is where the lawsuit was filed. But again, that decision could be overturned. And in the meantime, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case stemming from the First Circuit's decision to reinstate this lawsuit. So Saylor's decision may ultimately be moot, depending on what the Supreme Court does here. Oral arguments are slated for Smith & Wesson versus Estados Unidos Mexicanos in March of next year. But as I said, the amicus briefs are starting to come in. Over the past couple of days, 18 different amicus briefs, all filed on behalf of, in defense, I should say, not on behalf of Smith & Wesson, but in defense of Smith & Wesson and these other firearm manufacturers. So everything from, and I'm just looking here, I'm going to go down the list real quick. We're not going to cover all 18 of them on the show today. But you have the American Constitutional Union and Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. They submitted their brief on December 2nd. And then yesterday we saw 17 others submitted, including the amicus brief of professors of tort law, statutory interpretation, and firearms regulation. The amicus brief of the Atlantic Legal Foundation, the Landmark Legal Foundation submitted a brief. State of Montana submitted a brief. National Rifle Association and the Independence Institute submitted a brief, as well as the National Association of Manufacturers and the American Tort Reform Association. The National Shooting Sports Foundation submitted a brief of their own. Also, Gun Owners of America, Gun Owners Foundation, Gun Owners of California, the Heller Foundation, Tennessee Firearms Association, Tennessee Firearms Foundation, Grassroots North Carolina, Rights Watch International, Virginia Citizens Defense League, Virginia Citizens Defense Foundation, America's Future, U.S. Constitutional Rights Legal Defense Fund, and the Conservative Legal Defense Fund and Education Fund submitted an amicus brief. It is not uncommon, by the way, for organizations to sort of pool their resources and file these amicus briefs jointly. Then you had a amicus brief from the Chamber of Commerce of the United States of America, the Farmers Regulatory Accountability Coalition, FRAC, which is one of the groups that was going after, I believe, the stabilizing brace rule, as well as Hill Country Class 3 LLC, also known as a silencer shop, NST Global, also known as SB Tactical, and Palmetto State Armory. An amicus brief filed by the Firearms Policy Coalition, one filed by the National Association for Gun Rights and the National Foundation for Gun Rights. Second Amendment Foundation filed an amicus brief yesterday. And then there was one from the American Free Enterprise Chamber of Commerce as well. The two briefs that we're going to be focused on today, one was filed on behalf of the U.S. House of Representatives, just in its entirety. The other was filed on behalf of U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, U.S. Representative Daryl Issa, and 37 other members of Congress, both in the House and the Senate. And the reason why I want to focus on those particular amicus briefs, we're going to be covering some of the others at Bearing Arms. But in a way, this lawsuit brought again by the government of Mexico is a direct assault not only on our right to keep and bear arms, but on our system of government. Right. Congress passed the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act on a bipartisan basis, by the way, in 2005. It was signed into law by then President George W. Bush. And the Mexican government is essentially asking the court to disregard what Congress has done, to disregard what then President George W. Bush did in 2005, and to, again, allow this foreign government to try to sue U.S. gun makers out of existence. So they're asking for $10 billion in damages, in addition to all of the quote-unquote remedies that they want to see put in place, basically enacting gun control through judicial fiat rather than through legislation. In fact, the amicus brief filed by the House of Representatives states, specifically, the Mexican government at bottom is trying to dragoon the judiciary into exercising legislative power. It is asking the lower court to impose regulations that Congress has consistently refrained from enacting. Such an outcome would run afoul of the separation of powers and is exactly what Congress sought to prevent when it passed the Protection Act. Affirming the judgment below would therefore gut the Protection Act and threaten our constitutional order. The court should reverse the First Circuit's decision. The House of Representatives amicus brief goes on to delve into these arguments in some greater detail, saying that the authority to regulate the firearms industry rests with Congress, not the courts. And Congress has decided that firearms manufacturers generally should not be held liable for third parties' criminal actions. The House amicus brief also states that the decision below, where the First Circuit reinstated this lawsuit, usurped Congress's legislative power, and if affirmed, would allow a foreign government to use courts to impose firearms regulations that Congress has declined to adopt. They say if this court affirms the decision below, the Protection Act's narrow exception, that predicate exception that we talked about earlier, would swallow the rule, and firearms manufacturers would face liability that Congress intended to prevent. Federal courts, in turn, they say, would be asked to second-guess Congress's policy decisions regarding firearms regulation through requests for injunctive relief. This result would upset the separation of powers. Congress is charged with making such policy judgments, not Article III courts. They go on to say that according to the First Circuit, the petitioner's lawful sales of a legal product that eventually finds its way to bad actors constitutes aiding and abetting those bad actors. And that purported aiding and abetting in the form of legal business practices is the proximate cause of harms caused by third-party criminals. As they say, this distorted view of both aiding and abetting and proximate cause, if accepted, would gut the Protection Act. And they're absolutely right about that. And that is the Mexican government's argument, that these legal gun sales and these legal practices from the firearms industry are the proximate cause, are the reason for the cartel violence south of the border. Not the cartel members themselves, not the actions of the Mexican government, not the corruption that is rife within the Mexican government, not the hugs, not bullets strategy adopted by the Mexican government. Right? No. It's U.S. gun sales. That's the reason for the cartel violence. That's the allegation from the Mexican government. Now, the amicus brief from Senator Cruz, Representative Issa and the 37 other members of Congress. I won't read them all to you, but a pretty good bunch from both the House and Senate. Is not an exact repetition of the House's amicus brief. While there is generally no coordination between these groups that have filed Friends of the Court briefs, typically what you want to do is you want to try to buttress a particular a claim or particular argument that was raised by, in this case, Smith and Wesson and the other gun makers, right? You don't really want to give the court a whole bunch of the same argument, right? That's going to make the justices' eyes gloss over. Maybe these amicus briefs aren't going to get read. So while there are some similar arguments between the House brief and the brief filed by Senator Cruz, Representative Issa, and other members of Congress, there are some distinctions. The Cruz-Issa brief talks specifically about how this lawsuit attempts to subvert our right to keep and bear arms, whereas the House amicus brief talks generally about how this is an attempt to usurp the legislative branch's authority here, right? In the Cruz-Issa brief, they argue that the court should reject Mexico's spurious argument that the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act is categorically inapplicable, as well as its other arguments on the merits. Mexico's lawsuit thus disrespects the U.S. Constitution and U.S. law. They go on to say, well, Mexico may not place much stock in the Second Amendment. The right to keep and bear arms is fundamental to our scheme of ordered liberty. This right predates the amendment's adoption in 1791. But the concept of everyday law-abiding citizens being able to own firearms is a distinctly American right. By the time the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, the right's focus came to include personal protection against criminal elements, in addition to concern about an oppressive central government. But throughout our history and tradition, this right has remained fundamental to American liberty. They say that the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act would not permit a U.S. plaintiff to bring this suit in district court against U.S. gun makers for purported injuries such as these if they were suffered by U.S. citizens on U.S. soil, invoking U.S. law. And for all of these reasons, they say it follows the a fortiori that the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act does not permit a foreign plaintiff to bring this suit in district court for these purported injuries suffered by foreign citizens on foreign soil, invoking not only U.S. law, but also foreign law. The Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act bars this suit. Imagine, if you will, the city of Chicago filing suit against U.S. gun makers, saying that their legal practices are the reason why violent crime is so high in Chicago. In fact, we don't even have to imagine that. That is essentially the argument that the city of Chicago is making in its lawsuit against Glock, alleging that the gun makers' legal practices are fueling violence because people are illegally converting semi-automatic Glock handguns into full-auto machine guns. Now, rather than blame the criminals for the illegal conversion, City of Chicago wants to blame the gun maker Glock for those actions of criminals, right? And again, arguing that the legal practices of Glock are the predicate cause for the harm being done by violent criminals in Chicago. Now, that case is in the early stages, and I suspect that the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act is going to come in play there, but it certainly comes into play when we're talking about a foreign government blaming their inability or unwillingness to crack down on cartel violence on U.S. gun makers. Now, Cruz, Issa et al. Say none of this is to say that if Mexico considers itself aggrieved by the American firearms industry, that it has no recourse. Quite the contrary. Mexico has a full range of diplomatic tools at its disposal, they say. And this is where the complaint would be properly directed, to the U.S. Department of State, with the goal of bringing it to the attention of the White House. If Mexico believes that the United States is not meeting its international obligations, then the President of Mexico should seek action from the President of the United States. But that's not what has happened. This lawsuit, which was brought under Obrador's administration, they didn't reach out to Joe Biden. And they probably would have had a very willing partner in the Biden administration to team up and go after gun makers. But they didn't take that step. They didn't file a complaint with the State Department. Instead, they worked with a gun control group to file suit against the firearms industry. And even with New Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum in office. There's been no move that I'm aware of to pull back this lawsuit, to end it voluntarily on the part of the Mexican government, and to work with the Biden or the Trump administration in terms of combating cartel violence. Nothing like that. They are, again, still hoping that the U.S. courts will do what Congress has declined to do, which is adopt all kinds of Mexican-style gun control laws. So, as I said, oral arguments here are going to take place in March, just a couple of months away. I am cautiously optimistic that the Supreme Court is going to do the right thing here and turn away Mexico's $10 billion lawsuit. But we have seen some very good arguments as to why the court should make that decision. We'll be covering more of these amicus briefs at BearingArms.com today and probably tomorrow as well, since we have, now that we've covered two of them, 16 others to get through. Probably not going to do that all in one day, but we will be covering more of these amicus briefs and the arguments contained within these briefs today and in the days ahead at BearingArms.com. So I encourage you to check that out. And in the meantime, stay tuned, because Smith & Wesson, this lawsuit is soon going to be appearing before the justices on the high court. Before you know it, March will be here. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day and our recidivist report. We're going to start there. Now, this is a story that's actually a few days old, and I wanted to talk about it when I was away, but I didn't have the opportunity. So I'm making the executive decision that even though I try to do stuff on a little more timely basis than, you know, two-week-old stories, I want to talk about this. Because in Louisiana, which, you know, adopted constitutional carry earlier this year, we saw so much opposition from officials in New Orleans. They said, oh, constitutional carry is going to empower criminals. It's going to lead to blood on the streets. They tried to turn most of the French Quarter into a gun-free zone by declaring a police substation to be an educational facility. Tried to partner with a VOTEC in order to turn that into a school building instead of a police station. That hasn't worked, by the way. As far as I'm aware, the French Quarter is not a gun-free zone. Now, there's also been a push by city officials to get private businesses to post their property as gun-free. And they've had more success, I think, with that. But they have not been able to implement a French Quarter-wide or a city-wide exemption to the permitless carry policy. Now, interestingly enough, homicides have actually declined dramatically in New Orleans this year, which is a very good thing. And I'm not saying it's because of the permitless carry law. I'm just saying that even with the permitless carry law in place, the predictions from the gun control activists have not come to pass. Last year, and I'm looking here as of October the 6th, excuse me, which is the most recent data that I've got available to me, homicides in New Orleans were down by almost 41% compared to 2023. I mean, that is a staggering decline. And again, according to the gun control activists, it shouldn't have happened. Because with permitless carry in place, it should be the Wild Wild West. It should be anarchy. Now, New Orleans is not crime-free. But again, permitless carry doesn't have anything to do with that. Just as we see in every other city out there, the drivers of violent crime, very small percentage of the population, who are responsible for a disproportionate amount of violence. And that is the case with a recent shooting in the French Quarter. Here's the headline. French Quarter shooting tied to felons' probation and justice system failures, court records reveal. Watchdog group in New Orleans said you still had the ace in the hole of the convicted felon in possession of a firearm, and the DA's office essentially threw that ace away. You know, this is something that we just don't talk about often enough. And the media doesn't talk about this often enough, right? They really present gun control policies as if they are the answer. Just put this law in place and crime is going to go down. No. Again, criminals aren't going to abide by these gun control laws. Violent criminals don't care if they're walking into a gun-free zone or illegally possessing a firearm, if they're willing to commit murder or armed robbery or violent carjacking. Right? This is where the consequences for those crimes come into play. And if there are no consequences for those crimes, or the criminal element believes that they can get away with these crimes, then you will see more of these types of incidents. In this case, the 28-year-old who was recently charged with murder in a mass shooting in the French Quarter, Nicholas Miurana, was repeatedly granted leniency that allowed him to remain on the streets, according to court records and according to WWL-TV in New Orleans. They report that he had already served a 7-year prison sentence for armed robbery when he was arrested last year and booked on charges of domestic battery, child endangerment, and a series of gun charges, including being a felon in possession of a firearm. Now, we've talked before about felon in possession charges. I happen to believe that this, you know, blanket prohibition on anybody who has been convicted of a felony is unconstitutional, because not every person convicted of a felony is a dangerous person. Look at somebody like Brian Range, who was convicted in Pennsylvania 30 years ago of trying to falsify his income on a food stamp application. That was actually a misdemeanor crime, but it was punishable by more than a year and day, more than a year and a day in jail. So it was basically punished as a felony. Brian Range got probation, but he also lost his right to keep and bear arms for the rest of his life. Brian Range is not a dangerous person, so why should he lose his Second Amendment rights? But when it comes to individuals with a violent criminal history, I think that argument becomes a lot harder to justify. I know that there are folks who say, listen, once you've done the time for the crime, once you get out, it should be a clean slate, right? You get your right to vote restored. Why shouldn't you have all of your other rights restored? And I see the merits of that argument. I just don't think that the Supreme Court is going to find much favor with that. I think that they are intent on at least applying a dangerousness standard. And in that case, Miurana arguably met that standard. Again, the original felony conviction for armed robbery. And then last year, booked on charges of domestic battery, child endangerment, as well as being a felon in possession of a firearm. But WWL says the breaks that Miurana received by the criminal justice system began almost immediately upon his guilty plea to most of those charges in January of this year. From his generous plea deal to a sentence of probation, and culminating with near daily violations of his probation while on an electronic ankle monitor and house arrest. In fact, police say that Miurana was wearing that ankle bracelet when he and two accomplices jumped out of a car and shot 4 people just a couple of weeks ago in broad daylight. With the help of that monitor, WWL says Miurana was arrested within hours of the shooting. But in January of this year, almost 12 months ago, the district attorney's office allowed him to plead guilty to attempted possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. While a felon in possession carries a mandatory minimum 5-year sentence under Louisiana law, when you drop the charge to an attempted possession, then the defendant becomes eligible for probation. And that's exactly what happened here. Criminal court judge Leon Roche granted Miurana probation, and the next court activity came about 8 months later in August, when his probation officer filed to revoke Miurana's probation. Court records, according to WWL, don't reveal the nature of his alleged violations, but less than a month later, he was booked with domestic abuse battery. That could have been grounds for immediate revocation of his probation, but instead the judge ordered Miurana to remain on house arrest and be fitted out with an ankle monitor. That was in September. There were violations of his home confinement that were logged almost daily. But despite that, the judge actually loosened Miurana's parole conditions and allowed him to go to work at a car wash from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day. From that point, according to WWL, again, there were violations of the judge's orders nearly every day, starting on October the 8th. And the judge was well aware of this because these violation reports were sent to him by the monitoring company. Now, Rafael Goyenech, who's the president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission, which is a crime watchdog group in New Orleans, said neither the district attorney's office or the judge did their duty. And those failures put into motion the chain of events that resulted in the mass shooting in the French Quarter. He said it is a classic case of a system failure, both on the part of the district attorney's office and the sentencing judge. WWL says they reached out to Judge Roche. He's not responded. The DA in New Orleans, Jason Williams, criticized the court for not taking action I mean, Your Honor has repeated violations of his house arrest, but they say that his office has not responded to questions about the plea bargain that allowed me, Your Honor, to be released from probation in the first place. So in addition now to one count of second-degree murder, three counts of attempted second-degree murder, Your Honor still faces the domestic abuse battery charge from September. And as WWL laid out, there's no reason for this guy to be out on the streets other than the lax prosecution, the sweetheart plea deal, and a judge's inexplicable decision to keep him out on the streets despite almost daily violations of his probation. So there you go. Permitless carry, nothing to do with that crime. Affairs of the criminal justice system, yeah. If you want to point the finger at anybody other than the perpetrator of these attacks, or the alleged perpetrator of these attacks, then you can start with the judge and the DA. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story. An update for you from something we covered several months ago, actually, a story out of California, where this was apparently a targeted home invasion, and the homeowner fought back, shooting at least one of these suspects. One of these suspects ended up taking their own life afterwards. The three surviving defendants have all now pled guilty to this violent burglary in Newport Beach, California. And this could also be our deal of the day, too, I have to say. Andrew Miguel Rosas, age 25, pleaded guilty to burglary, kidnapping for ransom, extortion, or to commit a robbery, attempted robbery, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, and conspiracy. All of those felony charges. There were also sentence enhancements for being armed with a gun in the commission of a felony. And what did Rosas receive? You ready for this? 6 years. That's it. 6 years. And with time off for good behavior, that six-year sentence, probably closer to three under California law. His co-defendant, 42-year-old Jose Guadalupe Hernandez, pleaded guilty to burglary, kidnapping for ransom slash extortion or to commit a robbery, attempted robbery in a home, and conspiracy, all felonies. Also had a sentence enhancement for being armed with a gun. He got 9 years in prison. So he keeps his nose clean behind bars, maybe four and a half. Bernadette Cortez pleaded guilty to the same charges as Hernandez. She was sentenced to 6 years behind bars. And again, more like three when all is said and done. My News LA says, according to Newport Beach Police, two of these suspects entered the home back in April 16th. And what investigators believe was a targeted attack, a homeowner fired shots at them. Rosas was accused of breaking in about 4:45 in the morning. Officers arrested Rosas at the scene. He had been wounded by the homeowner. They began searching for a second suspect who was found dead in bushes outside of the home, apparently from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The name of that suspect never was released. Police said there were four people inside the home when the home invasion took place, a man, two women, and a child. Suspects had brought zip ties and rope, had attempted to take the victim's cell phone to prevent them from calling police. And according to the prosecution, Rosas, who again got that six-year sentence that's probably going to get 3 years with time off for good behavior, has prior convictions as an adult and, quote, sustained petitions in juvenile delinquency proceedings, excuse me, of a numerous and increasing seriousness. So this is a guy whose criminal history starts as a juvenile, has continued throughout adulthood. He's 25 now, already a convicted felon. And again, 6 years on paper, 3 years in practice. I mean, that is absolutely insane. And all the more reason why Californians need to be able to exercise their Second Amendment right of self-defense. Because frankly, the criminal justice system is not protecting them from violent offenders like Rosa. So they absolutely need to be able to protect themselves. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. An Indiana man who came to the aid of two infants that he found abandoned in a ditch while he was checking for mail. I mean, what a heartbreaking story. Robert Dean said he had gone out of his home to check his mail Monday morning when he saw two car seats. They were just lying in a ditch by the side of the road. And then he heard the infants strapped into those car seats wailing. He said one of them was screaming, so I immediately grabbed the car seats. I brought them inside. We got them warmed up, called 911. It was below freezing, by the way, at the time. Dean, before he had made his call, as it turns out, Indianapolis police had been called to another scene about 4 miles away, where a 2013 Hyundai Sonata had been stolen with these little girls, who were cousins, sitting in the back seat. Metropolitan Police says they had just begun searching for the car and the babies when they got Dean's call, who said, "Hey, I just found these two infants on the side of the road here." New York Post reports it remains unclear how long the babies were out in the 27-degree weather or why they were alone in the backseat of the car when it was stolen. But Indianapolis police spokesman William Young hailed Dean as a good Samaritan who helped get the girls out of the cold before they were affected by the element. He said that he did what any good person would do. He got those infants to shelter. He said that's an outcome that we wanted. Cannot thank that good Samaritan enough. The stolen car has been located, but so far, no suspects have been identified. Young, the police spokesman, did note that this is the second time in 2 weeks when a baby has been abducted sort of inadvertently during a car theft. Back on November 20th, a baby boy was kidnapped when a suspect stole a Chevy Equinox. And the police are now warning parents, don't leave your kids in the car unattended. Doesn't matter if, you know, you've got the car on, it's warming up, you've just run into the home to get something, then you're coming right back out. Don't do that. First of all, it's not a great idea to leave your car running in the driveway. It is just a target of opportunity. Or leave your car running when you run into the convenience store and grab a pop or something like that. That's just a bad idea. But to do that when you've got kids in the car, again, man, even if you think you live in a safe neighborhood, nothing like this has ever happened to me, nothing like this has ever happened here, I'm just going to be in for 15 seconds, I'll be right out. It's not worth the risk. I mean, three kids taken in two separate car thefts over the past 2 weeks. That is scary. But again, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to help these children in need, Robert Dean in Indianapolis, Indiana, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. I would encourage you to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information. We've got oral arguments in the Ninth Circuit in Rhodey versus Bonta today. That is the challenge to California's ammunition background check law, the same law that forbids California residents from buying ammo online or from buying ammo out of state and bringing it back across state lines into California. We'll be covering that story and much more at BearingArms.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. And by the way, if you like what you see here at Cam & Company or at BearingArms.com, I would encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member of Town Hall Media. All you have to do is go to BearingArms.com/subscribe, and you can sign up there. We certainly do appreciate your support. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.